from its cell, his sackcloth and girdle of thorns, would be luxury and indulgence compared with what I suffer. Adieu. I see no end to this misery but the grave. The 3rd of September. I must away. Thank you, Wilhelm, for determining my wavering purpose. For a whole fortnight I have thought of leaving her. I must away. She has returned to town and is at the house of a friend. And then, Albert. Yes, I must go from here. The 10th of September. Oh, what a night, Wilhelm. I can henceforth bear anything. I shall never see her again. Oh, why cannot I fly into your arms, and with floods of tears and raptures give utterance to all the passions which distract my heart? Here I sit, gasping for breath, and struggling to compose myself. I wait for day, and at sunrise the horses are to be at the door. And she is sleeping calmly, little suspecting that she has seen me for the last time. I am free. I have had the courage, in a conversation lasting 2 hours, not to betray my intention. And, oh, Wilhelm, what a conversation it was! Albert had promised to come to Lotta in the garden immediately after supper. I was upon the terrace under the tall chestnut trees, and watched the setting sun. I saw it sink for the last time beneath this delightful valley and silent stream. I had often visited the same spot with Lotta, and witnessed that glorious sight, and now I was walking up and down the very avenue which was so dear to me. A secret sympathy had frequently drawn me here before I knew Lotta, and we were delighted when, in our early acquaintance, we discovered that we each loved the same spot, which is indeed as romantic as any that ever captivated the fancy of an artist. From beneath the chestnut trees there is an extensive view, but I remember that I have mentioned all this in a previous letter and have described the tall mass of beech trees at the end, and how the avenue grows darker and darker as it winds its way among them, till it ends in a gloomy recess which has all the charm of a mysterious solitude. I still remember the strange feeling of melancholy which came over me the first time I entered that dark retreat, one bright noon. I felt some secret foreboding that it would, one day, be to me the scene of some happiness or misery. I had spent half an hour struggling between the contending thoughts of going and returning when I heard them coming up the terrace. I ran to meet them. I trembled as I took her hand and kissed it. As we reached the top of the terrace, the moon rose from behind the wooded hill. We spoke of this and that, and without perceiving it, approached the gloomy bower. Lotta entered and sat down. Albert seated himself beside her. I did the same, but my agitation did not suffer me to remain seated for long. I got up and stood before her, then walked backward and forward and sat down again. I was restless and miserable. Lotta drew our attention to the beautiful effect of the moonlight, which threw a silver hue over the terrace in front of us, beyond the beech trees. It was a glorious sight, and was rendered more striking by the darkness which surrounded the spot where we were. We remained silent for some time when Lotta observed, "Whenever I walk by moonlight, it brings to my remembrance all my beloved and departed friends, and I am filled with thoughts of death and the future to come." "There is a future life, Werther," she continued with a firm but feeling voice. "But shall we know one another again? What do you think? What do you say?" "Lotta," I said as I took her hand in mine, and my eyes filled with tears, "we shall see each other again. Here and hereafter we shall meet again." I could say no more. Why, Wilhelm, should she put this question to me, just at the moment when the fear of our cruel separation filled my heart? "And oh, do those departed ones know about us? Do they know when we are well and happy? Do they know when we recall their memories with the fondest love? In the silent hour of evening, the shade of my mother hovers around me. When seated in the midst of my children, I see them gather round me, as they used to gather round her, and then I raise my anxious eyes to heaven and wish she could look down upon us and witness how I fulfil the promise I made to her in her last moments, to be a mother to her children. With what emotion do I then exclaim, 'Forgive me, dearest of mothers, forgive me if I am not to them what you were to them. Alas, I do my utmost, they are clothed and fed, and still better, they are loved and cared for.' Could you but see, sweet saint, the peace and harmony that dwells amongst us. You would glorify God with the warmest feelings of gratitude, to whom in your last hour you address such fervent prayers for our happiness." Oh, Wilhelm, that is what she said. But who can do justice to her language? How can the cold, dead letter convey the heavenly expressions of the spirit? Albert interrupted her gently. "This affects you too deeply, my dear Lotta. I know your soul dwells on such recollections with intense delight, but I beg you—" "Oh, Albert," she said, "I'm sure you do not forget the evenings when we three used to sit at the little round table, when Papa was absent and the little ones had gone to bed. You often had a good book with you, but seldom read it. The conversation of that noble soul was preferable to anything. That beautiful, bright, gentle, and yet ever-toiling woman. God alone knows how I have prostrated myself in tears before him on my bed, that I might be like her." I threw myself at her feet, and seizing her hand, bedewed it with a thousand tears. "Lotta," I exclaimed, "God's blessing and your mother's spirit are upon you." "Oh, that you had known her," she said, with a warm pressure of the hand. "She was worthy of being known to you." I thought I should have fainted. Never had I received praise so flattering. She continued, "And yet she was doomed to die in the flower of her youth, when her youngest child was scarcely 6 months old. Her illness was but short, but she was calm and resigned, and it was only for her children, especially the youngest, that she felt unhappy. When her end drew nigh, she bade me bring them to her. I obeyed. The younger ones knew nothing of their approaching loss, while the elder ones were quite overcome with grief. They stood around the bed, and she raised her feeble hands to heaven and prayed over them. Then, kissing them in turn, she dismissed them and said to me, 'Be you a mother to them.' I gave her my hand. 'You are promising much, my child,' she said, 'a mother's fondness and a mother's care. I have often witnessed by your tears of gratitude that you know what is a mother's tenderness. Show it to your brothers and sisters, and be dutiful and faithful to your father as a wife. You will be his comfort.'" She asked where he was. He had withdrawn to conceal his intolerable anguish. He was heartbroken. "Albert, you were in the room." She heard someone moving. She asked who it was, and desired you to approach. She surveyed us both with a look of composure and satisfaction, expressive of her conviction that we should be happy, happy with one another. Albert fell upon her and kissed her, and exclaimed, "We are happy, and we shall be happy." Even Albert, generally so tranquil, had quite lost his composure, and I was excited beyond expression. "And such a woman, Werther," she continued, "was to leave us. God, must we part with everything we hold dear in this world?" Nobody felt this more acutely than the children. They cried and lamented for a long time afterwards, complaining that men in suits of black had carried away their dear mamma. Lotta rose. It stirred me, but I continued sitting and held her hand. "Let us go," she said. "It's growing late." She attempted to withdraw her hand. I held it still. "We shall see each other again," I exclaimed. "We shall recognize each other amidst all the shapes and forms." "I'm going," I continued. "Going willingly, but should I say forever, perhaps I may not keep my word. Adieu, Lotta. Adieu, Albert. We shall meet again." "Yes, tomorrow, I think," she answered with a smile. Tomorrow. How I felt the word. Ah, she little thought when she drew her hand away from mine. They walked down the avenue. I stood gazing after them in the moonlight. I threw myself upon the ground and wept. I then sprang up and ran out upon the terrace, and saw, under the shade of the lime trees, her white dress disappearing near the garden gate. I stretched out my arms, and she vanished. Book 2, the 20th of October, 1771. We arrived here yesterday. The envoy is indisposed and will not go out for some days. If he were less peevish and morose, all would be well. I see but too plainly that heaven has destined me to severe trials. But courage, a light heart may bear anything. A light heart. I smile to find such a word proceeding from my pen. A little more light-heartedness would render me the happiest being under the sun. But must I despair of my talents and faculties, whilst others of far inferior abilities parade before me with the utmost self-satisfaction? Gracious Providence, to whom I owe all my powers, why didst thou not withhold some of those blessings I possess, and substitute in their place a feeling of self-confidence and contentment? But patience, all will yet be well, for I assure you, my dear friend, you were right. Since I have been obliged to associate continually with other people and observe what they do and how they employ themselves, I have become far better satisfied with myself. For we are so constituted by nature that we are ever prone to compare ourselves with others, and our happiness or misery depends very much on the objects and persons around us. On this account, nothing is more dangerous than solitude. There our imagination, always disposed to rise, taking a new flight on the wings of fancy, pictures to us a chain of beings of whom we seem the most inferior. All things appear greater than they really are, and all seem superior to us. This operation of the mind is quite natural. We so continually feel our own imperfections, and fancy we perceive in others the qualities we do not possess, attributing to them also all that we enjoy ourselves, that by this process we form the idea of a perfect, happy man. A man, however, who only exists in our own imagination. But when, in spite of weakness and disappointments, we set to work in earnest and persevere steadily, we often find that though obliged continually to tack, we make more headway than others who have the assistance of wind and tide, and in truth there can be no greater satisfaction than to keep pace with others or outstrip them in the race. The 26th of November, 1771. I begin to find my situation here more tolerable, considering all circumstances. I find a great advantage in being much occupied, and the number of persons I meet and their different pursuits create a varied entertainment for me. I have formed the acquaintance of Count C, and I esteem him more and more every day. He is a man of strong understanding and great discernment, overseeing so much, but he is not on that account cold in his manner, but capable of inspiring and returning the warmest affection. He appeared interested in me on one occasion when I had to transact some business with him. He perceived, at the first word, that we understood each other, and that he could converse with me in a different tone from what he used with others. I cannot sufficiently esteem his frank and open kindness to me. It is the greatest and most genuine of pleasures to observe a great mind in sympathy with our own. The 24th of December, 1771. As I anticipated, the envoy causes me infinite annoyance. He is the most punctilious blockhead under heaven. He does everything step by step, with the trifling minuteness of an old woman, and he is a man whom it is impossible to please, because he is never pleased with himself. I like to do business regularly and cheerfully, and when it is finished, to leave it, but he constantly returns my papers to me, saying, "They will do," but recommending me to look over them again, as "one may always improve by using a better word or a more appropriate particle." I then lose all patience and wish myself at the devil's. Not a conjunction, not an adverb, must be omitted. He has a deadly antipathy to all those inversions of which I am so fond. And if the music of our sentences is not tuned to the established official key, he cannot comprehend our meaning. It is deplorable to be connected with such a fellow. My acquaintance with Count C is the only compensation for such an evil. He told me frankly, the other day, that he was much displeased with the difficulties and delays of the envoy, that people like him are hindrances both to themselves and to others. But, as he added, "one must submit like a traveller who has to get over a mountain. If the mountain was not there, the road would be both shorter and pleasanter, but there it is, and he must get over it." The old man himself perceives the Count's partiality for me. This annoys him, and he seizes every opportunity to denigrate the Count in my hearing. I naturally defend him, and that only makes matters worse. Yesterday he made me indignant, for he also alluded to me. "The Count," he said, "is a man of the world, and a good man of business. His style is good, and he writes with facility, but like other dilettantes, he has no solid learning." He looked at me with an expression that seemed to ask if I felt the blow. but it did not produce the desired effect. I despise a man who can think and act in such a manner. However, I made a stand and answered with not a little warmth. The Count, I said, was a man entitled to respect, both for his character and his accomplishments. I had never met a person whose mind was stored with more useful and extensive knowledge, who had, in fact, mastered such an infinite variety of subjects, and who yet retained all his activity for the details of ordinary business. This was altogether beyond his comprehension, and I took my leave, lest my anger should be too highly excited by some new absurdity of his. "And you are to blame for all this. You who persuaded me to bend my neck to this yoke by preaching a life of activity to me. If the man who plants vegetables and carries his corn to town on market days is not more usefully employed than I am, then let me work 10 years longer at the galleys to which I'm now chained." Oh, the brilliant wretchedness, the weariness that one is doomed to witness among the silly people whom we meet in society here. The ambition of rank. How they watch, how they toil to get ahead. What poor and contemptible passions are displayed in their utter nakedness. We have a woman here, for example, who never ceases to entertain the company with accounts of her aristocratic family and her estates. Any stranger would consider her a silly being, whose head was turned by her pretensions to rank and property. But she is, in reality, even more ridiculous, the daughter of a local chancery clerk. I cannot understand how human beings can so debase themselves. Every day I observe more and more the folly of judging of others by ourselves, and I have so much trouble with myself, and my heart is in such constant agitation, that I am well content to let others pursue their own course, if they only allow me the same privilege. What provokes me most is the unhappy extent to which distinctions of rank are carried. I know perfectly well how necessary are inequalities of condition, and I am aware of the advantages I myself derive from them. But I would not have these institutions prove a barrier to the small chance of happiness which I may enjoy on this earth. I have lately become acquainted with a Fräulein von B., a very agreeable girl who has retained her natural manners in the midst of artificial life. Our first conversation pleased us both equally, and at taking leave I requested permission to visit her. She consented in so obliging a manner that I waited with impatience for the arrival of the happy moment. She is not a native of this place, but resides here with her aunt. The countenance of the old lady is not prepossessing. I paid her much attention, addressing the greater part of my conversation to her, and in less than half an hour I discovered what Fräulein von B. subsequently acknowledged to me, that her aged aunt, having but a small fortune and a still smaller share of understanding, enjoys no satisfaction except in the pedigree of her ancestors, no protection save in her noble birth, and no enjoyment but in looking from her castle over the heads of the bourgeoisie. She was, no doubt, handsome in her youth, and in her early years probably trifled away her time in rendering many a poor youth the sport of her caprice. In her riper years she has submitted to the yoke of an elderly officer, who, in return for her person and her small independence, has spent with her what we may designate her age of bronze. He is dead, and she is now a widow and deserted. She spends her iron age alone, and would not be approached, except for the loveliness of her niece. The 8th of January, 1772. What beings are men whose whole thoughts are occupied with form and ceremony, who year after year devote their mental and physical exertions to the task of advancing themselves but one step, and endeavouring to occupy a higher place at the table? Not that such people would otherwise want employment. On the contrary, they give themselves much trouble by neglecting important business for such petty trifles. Last week a squabble over status arose during a sleigh ride, and all our amusement was spoilt. The silly creatures cannot see that it is not rank which constitutes real greatness, since the man who occupies the first place but seldom plays the principal part. How many kings are governed by their ministers? How many ministers by their secretaries? Who, in such cases, is really the chief? He, as it seems to me, who can see through the others, and possesses strength or skill enough to make their power or passions subservient to the execution of his own designs. The 20th of January. I must write to you from this place, my dear Lotta, from a small room in a country inn where I have taken shelter from a severe storm. During my whole residence in that wretched place, D, where I lived amongst strangers, strangers indeed to this heart, I never at any time felt the smallest inclination to correspond with you. But in this cottage, in this retirement, in this solitude, with the snow and hail beating against my lattice pane, you are my first thought. The instant I entered, your figure rose up before me, and the remembrance, oh, my Lotta, the sacred, tender remembrance. Gracious heaven, restore to me the happy moment of our first acquaintance. Could you but see me, my dear Lotta, in the whirl of dissipation, how my senses are dried up, but my heart is at no time full. I enjoy no single moment of happiness. All is vain. Nothing touches me. I stand, as it were, before the raree show. I see the little men and the little horses move, and I ask whether it is not an optical illusion. I'm amused with these figures, or rather, I am myself one of them. But when I sometimes grasp my neighbour's wooden hand, I feel that it is not natural, that I am played like a marionette, and I withdraw mine with a shudder. In the evening I say I will enjoy the next morning's sunrise, and yet I remain in bed. In the day I promise to ramble by moonlight, and I nevertheless remain at home. I know not why I rise, nor why I go to sleep. The yeast which leavened my existence is gone. The charm which cheered me in the gloom of night and aroused me from my morning slumbers is forever fled. I have found but one being here to interest me, a Fräulein von B. She resembles you, my dear Lotta, if anyone can possibly resemble you. Ah, you will say, he has learned how to pay fine compliments. And this is partly true. I have been very agreeable lately, as it was not in my power to be otherwise. I have, moreover, a deal of wit, and the ladies say that no one understands flattery better, or falsehoods, you will add, since the one accomplishment invariably accompanies the other. But I must tell you of Fräulein von B. She has abundance of soul which flashes from her deep blue eyes. Her rank is a torment to her, and satisfies no one desire of her heart. She would gladly retire from this whirl of fashion, and we often picture to ourselves a life of undisturbed happiness in distant scenes of rural retirement. And then we speak of you, my dear Lotta, for she knows you and renders homage to your merits. But her homage is not exacted, but voluntary. She loves you, and delights to hear you made the subject of conversation. Oh, that I was sitting at your feet in your favourite little room, with the dear children playing around us. If they became troublesome to you, I would tell them some fearful fairy tale, and they would crowd round me with silent attention. The sun is setting in glory. His last rays are shining on the snow, which covers the face of the country. The storm is over, and I must return to my dungeon. Adieu. Is Albert with you? And what is he to you? God forgive the question. The 8th of February. For a week now we have had the most wretched weather, but this to me is a blessing, for during my residence here not a single fine day has beamed from the heavens, but has been lost to me by the intrusion of somebody. During the severity of rain, sleet, frost, and storm, I congratulate myself that it cannot be worse indoors than abroad, nor worse abroad than it is within doors, and so I become reconciled. When the sun rises bright in the morning and promises a glorious day, I never refrain from exclaiming, "There now, they have another blessing from heaven which they will be sure to destroy." They spoil everything, health, fame, happiness, amusement, and they do this generally through folly, ignorance, or imbecility, and always, according to their own account, with the best intentions. I could often implore them on my bended knees to be less resolved upon their own destruction. The 17th of February. I fear that my envoy and I shall not continue much longer together. He is really growing past endurance. He transacts his business in so ridiculous a manner that I am often compelled to contradict him and do things my own way, and then, of course, he thinks them very ill done. He complained of me lately on this account at court, and the minister gave me a reprimand. A gentle one, it is true, but still a reprimand. In consequence of this, I was about to tender my resignation, when I received a letter to which I submitted with great respect, on account of the high, noble, and generous spirit which dictated it. Editor's note. Our great respect for this excellent gentleman led us to remove from this collection the aforementioned letter, together with another referred to later. Had we included it, we should have received the warmest thanks from our readers, but that would not, we felt, have excused the impertinence. End of editor's note. The minister endeavoured to soothe my excessive sensibility, paid a tribute to my extreme ideas of duty, of good example, and of perseverance in business, as the fruit of my youthful ardour, an impulse which he did not seek to destroy, but only to moderate, that it might have proper play and be productive of good. So now I am at rest for another week, and no longer at variance with myself. Content and peace of mind are valuable things. I could wish, my dear friend, that these precious jewels were less fleeting. The 20th of February. God bless you, my dear friends, and may He grant you that happiness which He denies to me. I thank you, Albert, for having deceived me. I waited for the news that your wedding day was fixed, and I intended on that day, with solemnity, to take down Lotta's silhouette from the wall, and to bury it with some other papers I possess. You are now united, and her picture still remains here. Well, let it remain. Why should it not? I know that I'm still amongst you, that I still occupy a place uninjured in Lotta's heart, that I hold the second place inside it, and I intend to keep it. Oh, I should become mad if she could forget. Albert, that thought opens up hell. Farewell, Albert, farewell. Angel of heaven, farewell, Lotta. The 15th of March. I have just suffered an affront which will drive me away from here. I am gnashing my teeth with rage. God, it is not to be remedied, and you alone are to blame, for you urged and forced me to take up a post for which I was by no means suited. It serves me right, and serves you right, too. But that you may not again attribute this fatality to my impetuous temper, I send you, my dear sir, a plain and simple account of the affair, as a mere chronicler of the facts would describe it. The Count of C. is very fond of me, and singles me out, it is well known, and I have mentioned this to you 100 times. Yesterday I dined with him. It is the day on which the nobility are accustomed to gather at his house, in the evening. I never once thought of the assembly, nor that we inferiors did not belong to such society. Well, I dined with the Count, and after dinner we adjourned to the large hall. We walked up and down together, and I conversed with him and with Colonel B., who joined us, and in this manner the hour for the assembly approached. God knows I was thinking of nothing when who should enter but the Honourable Ladyship von S., accompanied by her noble husband and their silly, scheming little goose of a daughter, with her small waist and flat neck, and with disdainful looks and a haughty air en passant. As I heartily detest the whole breed, I determined upon going away, and only waited till the Count had disengaged himself from their impertinent prattle to take leave, when the agreeable Fräulein von B. came in. As I never meet her without a lift to my heart, I stayed and talked to her, leaning over the back of her chair, and did not perceive, till after some time, that she seemed a little confused, and ceased to answer me with her usual ease of manner. I was struck with it. Heavens, I said to myself, can she too be like the rest? I felt annoyed and was about to withdraw, but I remained, notwithstanding, forming excuses for her conduct, fancying she did not mean it, and still hoping to receive some friendly recognition. The rest of the company now arrived. There was Baron F., in an outfit that dated from the coronation of France the First, Privy Councillor R., but Herr von R. in this context, with his deaf wife, and best of all the shabbily dressed J., whose old Franconian coat bore evidence of rather modern repairs. I conversed with some of my acquaintances, but they offered only laconic replies. I was engaged in observing Fräulein von B., and did not notice that the women were whispering at the end of the room, that the murmur extended by degrees to the men, That Frau von S. addressed the Count with much warmth, this was all related to me subsequently by Fräulein von B., till at length the Count came up to me and took me to the window. "You know our ridiculous customs," he said. "I perceive the company is rather displeased at your being here. I would not on any account—" "I beg your Excellency's pardon," I exclaimed. "I ought to have thought of this before, but I know you will forgive this little inattention. I was going," I added, "some time ago, but some evil genius detained me," and I smiled and bowed to take my leave. He shook me by the hand in a manner which expressed everything. I hastened at once from the illustrious gathering, sprang into a carriage, and drove to M. I contemplated the setting sun from the top of the hill, and read that beautiful passage in Homer, where Odysseus is entertained by the hospitable herdsman. Then all was well again. I returned home to supper in the evening, but few persons were assembled in the room. They had turned up a corner of the tablecloth and were playing at dice. Then Adeline, a good-natured fellow, came in. He laid down his hat when he saw me, approached me, and said in a low tone, "You have suffered some unpleasantness?" I exclaimed. "The Count ordered you to leave?" "Damn them all," I said. "I was very glad to be gone." "I'm delighted," he added, "that you take it so lightly. I'm only sorry that it is already so much spoken of." The circumstance then began to pain me. I fancied that everyone who sat down and even looked at me was thinking of this incident, and my heart became embittered. And now I could plunge a dagger into my heart when I hear myself everywhere pitied and observe the triumph of my enemies, who say that this is always the case with vain persons, whose heads are turned with conceit, who affect to despise social conventions and other such petty idle nonsense. Say what you will of fortitude, but show me the man who can patiently endure the laughter of fools when they have obtained an advantage over him. 'Tis only when their nonsense is groundless that one can suffer it without complaint. The 16th of March. Everything conspires against me. I met Fräulein von B. walking today. I could not help joining her, and when we were at a little distance from her companions, I expressed my sense of her altered manner towards me. "Oh, Werther," she said with some emotion, "you who know my heart, how could you so ill interpret my distress? What did I not suffer for you from the moment you entered the room? I foresaw it all. 100 times was I on the point of mentioning it to you. I knew that Lady S. and Lady T. with their husbands would quit the room rather than remain in your company. I knew that the Count would not break with them, and now so much is said about it." "How?" I exclaimed, and endeavoured to conceal my emotion, for all that Adeline had mentioned to me yesterday recurred to me painfully at that moment. "Oh, how much it has already cost me," said this amiable girl, while her eyes filled with tears. I could scarcely contain myself, and was ready to throw myself at her feet. "Explain yourself," I cried. Tears flowed down her cheeks. I became quite frantic. She wiped them away without attempting to conceal them. "You know my aunt," she continued. "She was present, and she saw everything, and you can imagine how. Last night and this morning, Werther, I was compelled to listen to a lecture upon my acquaintance with you. I have been obliged to hear you condemned and disparaged, and I could not, I dared not, say much in your defence." Every word she uttered was a dagger to my heart. She did not feel what a mercy it would have been to conceal everything from me. She told me, in addition, all the impertinence that would be further circulated, and how the malicious would triumph, how they would rejoice over the punishment of my pride, over my humiliation for that want of esteem for others with which I had often been reproached. To hear all this, Wilhelm, uttered by her in a voice of the most sincere sympathy, awakened all my passions, and I am still in a state of extreme agitation. I wish I could find a man to jeer me about this event. I would take up my sword and sacrifice him to my resentment. The sight of his blood might possibly be a relief to my fury. 100 times have I seized a dagger to give ease to this oppressed heart. I have heard tell of a noble race of horses that instinctively open a vein with their teeth when heated and exhausted by a long gallop, in order to breathe more freely. I am often tempted to open a vein, to procure for myself everlasting freedom. The 24th of March. I have tendered my resignation to the court. I hope it will be accepted, and you will forgive me for not having previously consulted you. It is necessary I should leave this place. I know you will all urge me to stay, and therefore I beg you will soften this news to my mother. I am unable to do anything for myself. How then should I be competent to assist others? It will afflict her that I should have interrupted that career which would have made me first a privy councillor and then envoy, and that I should look behind me instead of advancing, like a little horse returning to its stable. Argue as you will, combine all the reasons which should have induced me to remain, I am going. Enough! But that you may not be ignorant of my destination, I may mention that the Prince of Blank is here. He is much pleased with my company, and, having heard of my intention to resign, he has invited me to his country house to pass the spring months with him. I shall be left completely my own master, and as we agree on all subjects but one, I shall try my fortune and accompany him. Postscript, the 19th of April. Thanks for both your letters. I delayed my reply and withheld this letter till I should obtain an answer from the court. I feared my mother might apply to the minister to defeat my purpose, but my request is granted, my resignation is accepted. I shall not recount with what reluctance it was accorded, nor relate what the minister has written. You would only renew your lamentations. The Crown Prince has sent me a present of 25 ducats, and indeed such goodness has affected me to tears. For this reason, I shall not require from my mother the money which I lately requested. The 5th of May. I leave this place tomorrow, and as my birthplace is only 6 miles from the high road, I intend to visit it once more and recall the happy dreams of my childhood. I shall enter at the same gate through which I came with my mother, when, after my father's death, she left that delightful retreat to imprison herself in your melancholy town. Adieu, my dear friend. You shall hear of my excursion. The 9th of May. I have paid my visit to my native home with all the devotion of a pilgrim, and have experienced many unexpected emotions. Near the great lime tree, which is a quarter of an hour from the village, I got out of the carriage and sent it on before, that alone, on foot, I might enjoy vividly and heartily all the pleasure of my recollections. I stood there under that same lime tree which was formerly the goal and limit of my walks. How things have since changed! Then, in happy ignorance, I sighed for a world I did not know, where I hoped to find every pleasure and enjoyment which my heart could desire. And now, on my return from that wide world, oh, my friend, how many disappointed hopes and unsuccessful plans have I brought back! As I contemplated the mountains which lay stretched out before me, I thought how often they had been the object of my dearest desires. Here I used to sit for hours together with my eyes bent upon them, ardently longing to wander in the shade of those woods, to lose myself in those valleys which form so delightful an object in the distance. With what reluctance did I leave this charming spot! When my hour of recreation was over and my leave of absence expired, I drew near to the village. All the well-known old summer houses and gardens were recognized again. I disliked the new ones and all other alterations which had taken place. I entered the village and all my former feelings returned. I cannot, my dear friend, enter into details. Charming as my sensations were, they would be dull in the telling. I had intended to lodge in the marketplace, near our old house. As soon as I entered, I noticed that the schoolroom, where our childhood had been pent up by that good old woman, was converted into a shop. I called to mind the sorrow, the heaviness, the tears and oppression of heart which I experienced in that confinement. Every step produced some particular impression. A pilgrim in the Holy Land does not meet so many spots pregnant with tender recollections, and his soul is hardly moved with greater devotion. One incident will serve for illustration. I followed the course of a stream to a farm, formerly a delightful walk of mine, and paused at the spot where, when boys, we used to amuse ourselves making ducks and drakes upon the water. I recollected so well how I used formerly to watch the course of that same stream, following it with inquiring eagerness, forming romantic ideas of the countries it was to pass through. But my imagination was soon exhausted. While the water continued flowing farther and farther on, till my fancy became bewildered by the contemplation of an invisible distance. Exactly such, my dear friend, so happy and so confined, were the thoughts of our good ancestors. Their feelings and their poetry were fresh as childhood, and when Odysseus talks of the immeasurable sea and boundless earth, his epithets are true, natural, deeply felt and mysterious. Of what importance is it that I have learned, with every schoolboy, that the world is round? Man needs but little earth for enjoyment, and still less for his final repose. I am at present with the prince at his hunting lodge. He is a man with whom one can live happily. He is honest and unaffected. There are, however, some strange characters about him whom I cannot at all understand. They do not seem to be rogues, and yet they do not carry the appearance of thoroughly honest men. Sometimes I am disposed to believe them honest, and yet I cannot persuade myself to confide in them. It grieves me to hear the prince occasionally talk of things which he has only read or heard of, and always with the same view in which they have been represented by others. He values my understanding and talents more highly than my heart, but I am proud of the latter only. It is the sole source of everything of our strength, happiness, and misery. All the knowledge I possess everyone else can acquire, but my heart is exclusively my own. The 25th of May. I have had a plan in my head of which I did not intend to speak to you until it was accomplished. Now that it has failed, I may as well mention it. I wished to join the army and go to war, and had long been desirous of taking the step. This, indeed, was the chief reason for my coming here with the prince, as he is a general in service with, blank. I communicated my design to him during one of our walks together. He disapproved of it, and it would have been actual madness not to have listened to his reasons. The 11th of June. Say what you will, I can remain here no longer. Why should I remain? Time hangs heavy upon my hands. The prince is as gracious to me as anyone could be, and yet I am not at my ease. There is, indeed, nothing in common between us. He is a man of understanding, but quite of the ordinary kind. His conversation affords me no more amusement than I should derive from the perusal of a well-written book. I shall remain here a week longer and then start again on my travels. My drawings are the best things I have done since I came here. The prince has a taste for the arts, and would improve if his mind were not fettered by cold rules and mere technical ideas. I often lose patience when, with a glowing imagination, I'm giving expression to art and nature. He interferes with learned suggestions and blunders in with random artistic phrases. The 16th of June. Once more, I am a wanderer, a pilgrim through the world. But are you any more than this? The 18th of June. Where am I going? I will tell you in confidence. I'm obliged to continue a fortnight longer here, and then I think it would be better for me to visit the mines in blank. But I'm only deluding myself with this. The fact is, I wish to be near Lotta again. That is all. I smile at the suggestions of my heart and obey its dictates. The 29th of July. No, it is yet well. All is well. I, her husband, oh God, my Maker, if thou hadst destined this happiness for me, my whole life would have been one continual thanksgiving. But I will not complain. Forgive these tears. Forgive these futile wishes. She, my wife, oh, the very thought of folding that dearest of heaven's creatures in my arms. Dear Wilhelm, my whole frame shudders when I see Albert put his arms around her slender waist. And dare I say it? Why should I not, Wilhelm? She would have been happier with me than with him. Albert is not the man to satisfy the wishes of such a heart. He lacks a certain sensibility. He lacks, take it as you will, but their hearts do not beat in sympathy with each other. How often, my dear friend, I'm reading a passage from some interesting book, when my heart and Lotta's seem to meet, and in 100 other instances, when our sentiments were unfolded by the story of some fictitious character, have I felt that we were made for each other. But, dear Wilhelm, he loves her with his whole soul, and what does not such a love deserve? I have been interrupted by an insufferable visit. I have dried my tears and composed my thoughts. Adieu, my best friend. The 4th of August. I am not the only one to suffer. All men are disappointed in their hopes and deceived in their expectations. I have paid a visit to my good friend, the woman under the lime trees. The eldest boy ran out to meet me. His exclamation of joy brought out his mother, but she had a very melancholy look. Her first word was, "Alas, dear sir, my little Hans is dead." He was the youngest of her children. I was silent. And my husband has returned from Switzerland without any money, and if some kind people had not assisted him, he would have had to beg his way home. He was taken ill with fever on his journey. I could answer nothing but made the little one a present. She invited me to take some fruit, which I did, and left the place with a sorrowful heart. The 21st of August. My mood is constantly changing. Sometimes a happy prospect opens before me, but alas, it is only for a moment, and then when I am lost in reverie, I cannot help saying to myself, if Albert were to die, yes, she would become, and I should be, and so I pursue a chimera till it leads me to the edge of a precipice at which I shudder. When I pass through the same gate and walk along the same road which first led me to Lotta, my heart sinks within me at the change that has since taken place. All is altered. No sentiment, no pulsation of my heart is the same. My sensations are such as would occur to some departed prince, whose spirit should return to visit the splendid palace which he had built in happy times, adorned with costly magnificence, and left to a beloved son, but whose glory he should find departed, and its halls deserted and in ruins. The 3rd of September. I sometimes cannot understand how she can love another, how she dares love another, when I love nothing in this world so completely, so devotedly as I love her, when I know only her and have no other possession but her. The 4th of September. Yes, that is how it is. As nature puts on her autumn tints, it begins to be autumn in me and around me. My leaves are parched and yellowing, and the neighbouring trees are divested of their foliage. Do you remember my writing to you about a farmhand shortly after my arrival here? I have just asked after him in Walheim. They say he's been dismissed and is now avoided by everyone. I met him yesterday on the road going to a neighbouring village. I spoke to him, and he told me his story. It interested me exceedingly, as you will easily understand when I repeat it to you. But why should I trouble you? Why should I not reserve all my sorrow for myself? Why should I continue to give you occasion to pity and blame me? But no matter. This is all part of my destiny. At first, the farmhand answered my questions with a sort of subdued melancholy, which seemed to me the mark of a timid disposition. But as we grew to understand each other, he spoke with less reserve, and openly confessed his faults, and lamented his misfortune. I wish, my dear friend, I could give proper expression to his language. He told me, with a sort of pleasurable recollection, that after my departure his passion for his mistress increased daily, until at last he neither knew what he did, nor what he said, nor what was to become of him. He could neither eat, nor drink, nor sleep. He felt a sense of suffocation. He disobeyed all orders and forgot all commands without meaning to. He seemed as if pursued by an evil spirit, till one day, knowing that his mistress had gone to an upstairs room, he had followed, or rather, been drawn after her. As she proved deaf to his entreaties, he had recourse to violence. He knows not what happened, but he called God to witness that his intentions to her were honourable, and that he desired nothing more sincerely than that they should marry and spend their lives together. When he had come to this point, he began to hesitate, as if there were something he had not courage to utter, till at length he acknowledged with some confusion certain little confidences she had encouraged and liberties she had allowed. He broke off two or three times in his narration and assured me most earnestly that he had no wish to make her look bad, as he termed it, for he loved her still as sincerely as ever, that the tale had never before escaped his lips, and was only now told to convince me that he was not utterly lost and abandoned. And here, my dear friend, I must commence the old song which you know I utter eternally. If I could only represent the man as he stood, and stands now before me, could I only give his true expressions, you would feel compelled to sympathize in his fate. But enough. You who know my misfortune and my disposition can easily comprehend the attraction which draws me toward every unfortunate being, but particularly towards him whose story I've recounted. Reading this letter a second time, I find I have omitted the conclusion of my tale, but it is easily supplied. She became reserved towards him, at the instigation of her brother, who had long hated him and desired his expulsion from the house, fearing that his sister's second marriage might deprive his children of the handsome fortune they expected from her, as she is childless. He was dismissed at length, and the whole affair occasioned so much scandal that the mistress dared not take him back, even if she had wished it. She has since hired another servant, with whom, they say, her brother is equally displeased, and whom she is likely to marry. But my informant assures me that he himself is determined not to survive such a catastrophe. This story is neither exaggerated nor embellished. Indeed, I have weakened and coarsened it in the telling by sticking to the conventions of polite society. This love, then, this constancy, this passion is no poetic fiction. It is actual, and dwells in its greatest purity amongst that class of mankind whom we term rude, uncultured. We are the educated, not the deformed. But read this story with attention, I implore you. I am calm today, for I have been employed upon this narration. You see by my writing that I am not so agitated as usual. I read and reread this tale, Wilhelm. It is the history of your friend. My fortune has been and will be similar, and I am neither half so brave nor half so determined as the poor wretch with whom I hesitate to compare myself. The 5th of September. Lotta had written a letter to her husband in the country, where he was detained by business. It began, "My dearest love, return as soon as possible. I await you with 1,000 raptures." A friend who arrived brought word that for certain reasons he could not return immediately. Lotta's letter was not forwarded, and the same evening it fell into my hands. I read it and smiled. She asked the reason. "What a heavenly treasure is imagination!" I exclaimed. I fancied for a moment that this was written to me. She paused and seemed displeased. I was silent. The 6th of September. It cost me much to part with the blue coat which I wore the first time I danced with Lotta, but I could not possibly wear it any longer. But I have ordered a new one, exactly the same, even to the collar and sleeves, as well as a new buff yellow waistcoat and breeches. But it does not produce the same effect upon me. I know not how it is, but I hope in time I shall like it better. The 12th of September. She has been absent for some days. She went to meet Albert. Today I visited her. She rose to receive me, and I kissed her hand most tenderly.